I am doing, that is Taps, right? That is
Taps. Close. It's a little fast for Taps. You know, normally it sounds it sounds more like a wedding dance than Taps at that pace. I have to say, normally it's very slow.
I should tell everybody
really
to go to half speed when they first
half speed.
Listening.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Well, that was my best shot at Taps. But good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you all are. This is Trish Lambert standing in for Dave Kale, and we're at Riddles in the Dark. And the reason for that wedding song Taps is that we're saying farewell to Thorin in this episode of Riddles in the Dark. And with me is, of course, the one, the only, Tolkien professor Corey Olson. Hello.
Good morning. Good morning. So, yes, today we're, we have to put a sort of a blanket spoiler alert over today's episode, you know, because Thorin dies. That's...
No.
I know. though, you know, it's that to me raises a really interesting, the interesting question that I think we talked about last time. Did we? I can't even remember anymore. About, the issue of how do you do, you know, what kind of choice do you make when you're making an adaptation of a book which has, like, a surprise or a dramatic thing at the end, and you know,
right,
everyone's anticipating it because they've read the book. So I think that the role of Thorin, and this is why I feel that the petition to save Thorin's life is so cute but misguided, because it's I don't know. I mean, if you feel like this is sort of a story where you can just be like, okay, we're going to tell exactly the same story, except Thorin lives, you know.
That's right.
It's not the exact same story. I mean, like, it's just that it's just a very, again, cute, but simple-minded way of looking at the story.
You know, I'm trying to think of the adaptations. Like, for example, I remember one when I was doing research for a paper I presented, and discovered that Humphrey Carpenter, who is the person who actually wrote Tolkien's biography,
right,
in his younger days, wrote a play of The Hobbit, an adaptation, and he decided to move The Death of the Dragon to the Mountain, in his words, to put it in the center of the action. But I can't, you know, which is like, okay, and then Tolkien actually saw the play. Can you imagine?
Yes.
I mean, what hubris on Carpenter's part. But I cannot think of any adaptation, even the children's play, that actually had Thorin live. I don't think there's ever been an adaptation where that happened, correct?
I don't think.
Even Rankin Bass.
Even Rankin Bass killed off Thorin, though, of course, they callously killed off half the dwarves for no reason whatsoever.
That's true.
but yes. It is.
You know.
I mean, it's a fundamental part of the story all the way through,
right.
You know, and it's, I think it's one of those things, especially, which is sort of more, the awareness of that is even more keen. Thorin's death fits very well into the book, but it's not like, I don't think that whole story is sort of obviously, you know, kind of freighted with the awareness of Thorin's impending death from the beginning. You know, it's not like we're getting foreshadowing of Thorin's demise from day one. Like, it's
right.
Not how The Hobbit works as a story. But when you are doing a film adaptation of a classic book, which famously ends with the death and deeply moving deathbed scene of one of the principal characters, that is going to be something. I mean, I know it's been on my mind. I assume that for very many of us, if we made a short list of like the top five scenes we were most interested to see how they were going to handle in the adaptation, like if 3 years ago or 4 years ago, we had all gotten together and make this list, I assume that, you know, the riddle game scene and Thorin's deathbed might have been the top two scenes, that that were on our collective list of scenes that we were looking, you know, sort of central scenes that we were most anticipating in a film adaptation, or just, you know, most interested to see how they would handle. It's an absolutely crucial scene. Certainly, I think, in the minds and imaginations of readers. Again, not because it is in a sense like the sort of central moment of the book. Because, like I said, I don't think the plot anticipates it. It's part of the turn that the story takes at the end. But when you're doing an adaptation, it's got to be front and center in your mind. And I think that we have been seeing that. You know, I think that, unlike in the book, the Thorin that we meet on day one in Bag End in film one, you know, like, already has his deathbed scene written all over him. You know, I mean, like, he is a tragic figure from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me entirely appropriate. I mean, I think that, you know, because there are some things you can't, and I think shouldn't try to recreate, when you're doing an adaptation of something like that. I mean, they could try to create, you know, to depict Thorin as he's depicted in the book without that sense of, you know, sort of the doom that awaits him at the end of the story. But since in the minds of most of the viewers, we already have that doom in mind, I don't think there's much sense in trying to recreate that experience. So, of course, here I'm continuing to mull over this question that Neil Ottenstein raised at the Midmoot conference weekend before last, which I just thought was such a smart question to ask and such a smart thing to talk about. You know, just the entire way in which you approach a story when you're retelling a famous story, which has, you know, a twist or a surprise ending or something like that, and the way in which the very, very different place that you're in as a storyteller when you're approaching that the second time, you know, when you're doing a retelling and when you're doing an adaptation of that. And I think that this is something that they've really done quite well, actually. I think that they have set up Thorin for, I mean, I don't know exactly how well they're going to pull it off in film three at the end of the day, but they've set themselves up, I think, for a really satisfying character arc for Thorin from, you know, the beginning of film one through this.
Yeah, in Ratliff, you know, Ratliff has written the book, John Ratliff, about the process of writing The Hobbit. Thorin was always slated to have this sort of hero's death, wasn't he?
Well, sort of. I mean, it's not at all clear to me that Tolkien had any idea what was going to happen at the end of the story. You know, it's one of the things that I find most delightful and charming is, you remember that bit in, the chapter one of The Hobbit where, the narrator is talking about Bilbo, and says, this is a story of a hobbit who had an adventure. You know, and talks about how he lost the respect of the neighbors, and then says, but he gained, well, we'll see, you know, we'll see if you think he gained anything in the end.
That's
and,
right.
Of course, that comes off as, like, this very, like, sort of, you know, kind of prim piece of foreshadowing, right? Like, I, the narrator, of course, know what he's going to, but I'm not going to give that away, right? We will see. Tolkien wrote that in the first draft. Like, when he himself had literally no idea. Bilbo was going to gain. Like, Tolkien actually had no concept of what Bilbo was going to have gained. That absolutely grew along the way. And you can see it's very clear from the plot outlines that he drew. He at various points, had wildly different ideas about where this story was heading and how Bilbo's life was going to be changed. But I love the fact that that line, which works so well, and is one, I mean, it's one of my favorite moments of the Hobbit narrator in the book. And it was like a shot in the dark when Tolkien wrote it. And that's very, it's very funny. So, you know, is he slated for a tragic death? That's always a possibility, but I don't think there's like a very clear destiny for that. So
So it was something that sort of revealed itself as he wrote the story.
Yeah. I mean, there are sort of two different factors which emerge as the story goes on. One is really the whole, you know, what I call the Return of the King motif in The Hobbit, you know, the destined return of the dwarves to the Lonely Mountain and the return of the king under the mountain. Even more importantly than the return of the dwarves, that sort of more mythic sense of, you know, the return of the king, the king beneath the mountain, the king under the mountain, which by itself is one of those things, like that phrase alone, like you don't need a story, you know, just the phrase, the king under the mountain is a mythic idea, you know, like Tolkien, I think, is so good at that. You know, there are so many places where, even if you don't know the story at all, but you just know the phrase or the description, has itself a kind of mythic evocativeness? Evocation?
Yes, that works.
I guess.
Evocation.
Evocation is kind of different. But anyway, it's very evocative is what I'm trying to say. Anyway, that's chapter 10, you know, when they arrive at Lake Town, you know, and all of a sudden, Thorin is all like, I am Thorin, son of Thrain, son of Thror, king of the mountain, I return, you know, and that note was not really struck before. You know, we had hints of it, you know, there was, but that sense of, you know, and now all of a sudden we're getting these songs prophesying the return of the king and all those, you know, that all, you know, leaps into being in chapter 10.
Right.
And then the second strand that we get in the book is the dragon sickness strand, right? You know, when Thorin begins to fall into dragon sickness and then is redeemed in the Battle of Five Armies. So his tragic death seems to me really to kind of grow out of both of those two strands, neither of which seems to be there from the beginning at all, necessarily. However, in the films, it is there from the beginning. You know, that's you know, front and center in the films, which again I think seems to me a very appropriate approach to the thing.
I agree. I mean, plus you said a number of times that in the books, you know, he starts out just a grumpy old man. I mean, it's just not, that's just not practical in terms of the film to do that.
Right, a snooty old man looking down his nose at Bilbo.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, there's the kind of disdain that Thorin shows for Bilbo in the films, but it's very different from like the pure snobbishness, you know, that Thorin shows for Bilbo. I mean, and even you know, when you go to the quest, the quest for Erebor and stuff, you know, when we get more details of it, we see, oh, okay, so he's not only a snob, he's also a racist as well. You know, he also just despises hobbits, you know, on principle. You know, so that's
anybody not dwarf.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Brian Federini makes a great point that, you know, film Thorin is much less aristocratic than book Thorin. Yes. I think that's a really good way to think of it. That sense of aristocracy, that sense of his own family dignity is something that's very prominent in the book and not very prominent in the film. And part of that is because he's more of the tragic hero. He is the leader of a people who are in exile, you know, and the fact that his people are in exile and that they want, you know, that he wants to return them to their lands and to their, you know, to their own place and to the life that they knew, is, you know, the absolute bedrock of his character. And again, he was not in the book sort of first and foremost a leader. You know, he wasn't for, right. You know, he was first and foremost a tremendously important dwarf, which is how he's introduced to us in chapter one. So yeah, he was pompous, but he wasn't focused on the good of his people in ways that we see Thorin torn up about the good of his people from the beginning. You know, that conversation in film one that we get between Balin and Thorin, right? You know, and Thorin's desire to do this for his people and Balin saying, it's okay, you don't have to. And it's interesting because when you go back to the book, what Balin is voicing there is actually something, or at least it's close to something, that Thorin himself voices in the book. That is, you know, when Thorin says, you know, even though, you know, we're doing okay now and we're not too badly off, you know, but we still want to get our treasure back. You know, that is, he recognizes, like, okay, yeah, you know, we've had it rough for a while, but we're building a life for ourselves, and we've started to build a little bit of wealth. He touches, you know, when he says that, he touches the gold chain around his throat in the book, right? You know, he's like, you know, we still do. We I've got some money, right? You know, I have a bit laid by, as he says. And they're not so badly. I was like, you know, the dwarves are not mere paupers anymore, but they still don't have their treasure, and they still miss their treasure. And what they miss about their treasure seems to be more than just its financial value. But again, this Thorin, the film Thorin, is very different from the beginning. He is the leader of a people in exile. He is a person who is torn up about, you know, the sufferings of his people. And of course, about his own sort of perceived responsibility, or not responsibility for that, but failure in that. You know, he has, to use a phrase which Tolkien imposed upon Thorin much later on, you know, he has inherited the vengeance against, you know, the vendetta against the dragon, which lies upon his conscience as yet unfulfilled. That's not Thorin as we meet him in chapter one of The Hobbit. You know, that's Thorin as Tolkien later conceived him.
Right.
But that is Thorin as we meet him in the films. Mm-hmm. So the overall trajectory of Thorin's character from, you know, leader of the exiles who is trying to return, and of course it's all wrapped up in the good of his people as well as in his own self-image and his own, not his own rights, but his own identity, you know? Who is he? Is he the king of the dwarves? Is he, you know, he's not succeeding in being the king of the dwarves in the sense that he's not, you know, he's not taking care of his people. He's not able to provide a kingdom, you know, a place for his people. They're dispersed and in exile. But he also does not have the seat of his fathers. You know, he doesn't have the Arkenstone, and he doesn't, he is no longer a king under the mountain. So that combination of him wanting to prove himself and wanting to reestablish his own rights and his own identity as king under the mountain is sort of in parallel to, but I think also in a little bit of tension with, you know, his desire to provide for his people. This is where it's the tension there, where I think, so far anyway, I think that Peter Jackson, the way that Peter Jackson is weaving the dragon sickness plot into the return from exile plot is really quite cunning, actually. I think it works very well, because that bit of space, you know, there's like this tiny, you know, there's like this tiny crack between Thorin as compassionate leader of his people and Thorin as, like, frustrated and embittered person who is not king. You know, that is like the issue of the good of his people versus his own identity, and his own concept of kingship. But that's where I feel like the crack has come and has been widening, and widens very noticeably over the course of the second film. Thinking of that conversation with Feely that we've talked about many times in Lake Town, you know, where he's like, you know, far from a no dwarf left behind policy, you know, we can't compromise the mission for the sake of one dwarf. here he is basically putting the reestablishment of the kingship above the good of, you know, some of his people. You know, he's not first and foremost thinking of his people. Feely does that, right? Feely puts his loyalty to his brother above reestablishing the kingship.
Right.
By staying there. And then, of course, the conversation that he has with Balin, right, when Balin is rebuking him for just calling Bilbo the burglar. And, you know, Balin's whole point of view, I mean, I feel like that conversation really has to be placed next to the speech that Balin makes about Thorin in film one, right? You know, the whole, like, that's the, you know, when I saw, like, that's the king that I would follow, right? That the whole, his description of, as an Ulbazar. So basically, like, Thorin is focused on regaining the kingship, he's kind of losing that. This is why, you know, it is because I've been very interested in how they have done this, not only in how they have spotlighted these things which seem to work really well to me, you know, in Thorin's character. But also the way in which they've woven the dragon sickness stuff into that. That's why I was so interested in the golden statue business at the end of the Desolation of Smaug. You know, well, almost everybody else I knew was saying, what the heck is going on? This is ridiculous. I was saying, no, wait, hang on, that's really cool. Like, I, you know, if you put aside the fact that, you know, it's outrageously unlike anything that happens in the book, and you put aside the outrageous physical improbability or impossibility of many of the things that happen, nevertheless, what you're left with, once you have succeeded in ignoring all of those things, what you're left with is something which I think seemed to me to speak very directly to this question, and I thought in a really fascinating way. The image that we got of Thorin standing there, you know, like hanging there on the chains right above like the shoulder of the golden king statue facing Smaug, and you know, in defiance next to the statue, and then having the statue explode all over Smaug, I thought was a really, really effective symbolic moment in that film. You know, the king, the golden statue of the king under the mountain, because that was, I mean, it is like the perfect symbol of the abstract concept of the king under the mountain, right? The king under the mountain is this great, huge, epic figure made of solid gold. Like, it's an excellent, like, that image was an excellent image for the concept of the king under the mountain, which, you know, Thorin is, you know, which Thorin is sort of working towards, and which Thorin has kind of taken to himself, you know, which he's kind of striving for. But in that moment, Thorin simultaneously gains it and loses it, right? There he has returned to the mountain, and he has restored the king under the mountain, right? There's the golden statue. There was a mold. I mean, I love that idea of the fact that this mold existed, right? That in the heart of empty Erebor, well, mostly empty Erebor, occupied only by dragon Erebor, in the middle of dragon occupied Erebor, there was a mold, a king under the mountain shaped mold that was empty, you know, waiting for the king under the mountain to return and fill it. Like that forget the statue, the mold itself is an awesome image for, you know, like that aching need for the king under the mountain to return, you know, that's so, I love that. That's so neat. And then he does return, and the gold, he gets the forges of the dwarves again, right? Again, a very iconic idea for, you know, returning life to the mountain, right? If, you know, the dwarves are starting up their forges again. The king under the mountain is forging gold, they say in Lake Town, except this time it turns out to be true. And so, you know, they start up the forges under the mountain. The, you know, the life, the dwarven life has returned to the mountain, and the gold pours into the mold, and the golden king under the mountain is returned. But Thorin is using that not to declare his kingship, right? Not to celebrate himself. Not so that he can make this huge golden statue and then, like, you know, sit in front of it and, like, you know, bask in the reflected glory of this huge golden statue, but rather he's sacrificing it. You know, that whole mold is now going to go for nothing. Right. You know, it's, and in fact, it's just going to kind of wreck up his throne room. Not, but what, like, a coating of gold over the entire throne room is not an upgrade in some ways, don't get me wrong, but, anyway, but nevertheless, in fact, I'm sure at some point, those, like, you know, like, the golden footprints of Smaug leading out of the mountain are going to be quite the conversation pieces, you know, later on, but anyway,
I'll channel Dave here. I'm sure Dave would say something like, "It's amazing how much you can make of that scene, Corey."
Yeah. Well, see, this is to me the sign of a really rich moment in the film. You know, like it's. I mean, what is any of this stuff but raw material? And that's good raw material, man. Like, that's what I'm talking about. It's because the fact is, I know that, like, when I talk like this about a scene like this, it's easy to think, like, this is just me being clever, you know, and applying my own cleverness to this. But the fact is, I find that doesn't work all the time. You know, for me, this is one of the primary ways in which I evaluate both books and films is the material that they give for this kind of thinking. You know, the material they give for this kind, if a book is a really, you know, provides really fertile ground for these kind, you know, for sort of seeing these kinds of stories in them, for, you know, then it's a good book. In my world. I mean, that's how I decide. I am willing to put up, in films, I'm willing to put up with a very great deal of pointless decapitation if I am given scenes like that I can think about and talk about. Just as in a book, I'm willing to put up with an enormous amount of terrible writing, almost any number of dangling modifiers in order to get moments like that and scenes like that. Mm-hmm. There's some writers that still push the envelope, but, like, take, for instance, writers who do push the envelope. Take Stephanie Meyer and Twilight. My goodness. Had there been, you know, one scene in Twilight like that, I would have been able to tolerate her bad prose and boring story much, much more. it's the fact that I found Twilight utterly unevocative in this way, because it's all just, like, inviting you to do introspective, self-fantasizing navel-gazing that I disliked about it. But anyway, any of this kind of, so, you know, again, to me, this is about what's there. But keep in mind, I am not trying to claim that this was what they planned. You know, maybe the filmmakers had this particular symbol or this particular function of this symbol of the, you know, the statue mold and the statue. Maybe that's what Peter Jackson was thinking. Maybe that's what Philippa Boyens was thinking when, you know, or Fran Walsh when they wrote it. I don't know. But if they didn't, I don't care. It doesn't matter to me because that's my experience with all of literature. You know, half the time, the authors don't know what they're doing, and that's delightful. That's one of the things that makes literature awesome, is that it's this, like, you know, this sort of magical dynamic process, you know, which sort of works through the author. But goodness, if every book were only what the author conceived of it to be, it would be a duller world.
That's one of the reasons why I think software programs don't work for book writing.
Yes. Whatever it is that people like tap into, you know, which seems
Right.
to make them but the instrument of a story which is greater than they know, computers don't seem to have tapped into that yet. Maybe
No,
someday they will, but they, I don't think they
no.
have yet.
I personally, you know, you, I think you mentioned it earlier, and I do think, and we may be, you know, I'm probably repeating, you know, old news here, but I think they have done a better job with Thorin in the movie than Tolkien did in the book. I mean, not even they could have left him the same age as he was in the book, but you know, done a similar arc, and they would have done a better job. I just think there's a more, you know, you see Thorin being both impulsive and a king, even as early as an Ilbazar in the movie. And you see that, you know, follow through. Like obviously Azog, you know, he's got like an irrational streak when it comes to Azog, where he will literally put his life on the line just to, for a chance to get at him, kind of thing. But on the other hand, you know, the bravery and all this kind of stuff. And I just think it's they've made the character very consistent through the movie, and also, like you said, identifiable. You know, I mean, he's much easily I can identify with him in terms of follow him and be interested in him as a character. Much more so than I found in the book. So, but you know, I mean, Tolkien really, he literally was feeling his way, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why, you know, even to Thorin's death scene, you know, a lot of this is derived from the sagas and from the myths that he loved so much. And I don't even know at the time he wrote. I mean, I can't remember now, but I mean, it's like, you know, he's busy trying to get other stuff published for at least a long time while he was writing this story. I don't even know that that was in his mind. So, you know, there was no real, well, someday this may be made into a movie, or you know, or you know, I'm targeting the top of the New York Times bestseller list. You know, I mean, it's just that wasn't even part of his thinking.
No, not at all.
It's you know, it's almost like, I suppose you could put, I think I've said this before, you know, it's almost like The Hobbit was a writing exercise in preparation for The Lord of the Rings. I know that's on the horizon at this time, but it kind of is like that.
No, I agree. I mean, it's an obviously unhistorical way to think about it. But yeah, so looking at the big picture, yeah, there's no, and I was talking, you know, I talked about this in my Book of Lost Tales class, that to me, I think The Hobbit is even more than that. You know, that to me, I see The Hobbit as the turning point of Tolkien's career. You know, it was that moment when everything really came together. What we get before The Hobbit, is some comical stuff, you know, like of the Farmer Giles of Ham, you know, the Man in the Moon came down too soon kind of thing, Tom Bombadil, and the you know, the early versions of the Silmarillion material, the Book of Lost Tales stuff, and you know, the Lay of Lathian and the Alliterative Children of Húrin, and you know, the beginning of putting those things together into you know, into a sort of a historical overview in the 1930 Quenta and all that stuff. So we've got him working with the, you know, with the history of the elves and the Valar, and telling these great epic and tragic stories, and then in the hole in the ground there lived a hobbit, right? And that in that moment with Bilbo Baggins, and real because really I think it's about the hobbits themselves. You know, it's about Bilbo and the framework that the hobbits provide, the touchstone that the hobbits become, for the entire, you know, and the way that they become the sort of the medium through which we are introduced to the entire world and to the legendarium. That's the turning point, I think, in his entire life. So, you know, when he writes The Hobbit, which, you know, as I've argued before, I don't think was intended to be within the same world. I don't think he, you know, though obviously in the very first draft of chapter one, he thought of it that way, you know, or at least he was kind of toying around with that. By the way, I mean, again, for people who haven't read John Ratliff's History of the Hobbit, which I strongly recommend, in the first draft of chapter one, there's an overt reference to the fact that the story of Beren and Lúthien happened less than 100 years before, You know, like it's the Hobbit takes place in the immediate sort of historical context of that, but then he ditches it. He cuts that out almost immediately. Like his second draft of the chapter doesn't include that. So his very first toying with it was, oh yeah, this will be right. You know, I'll sort of continue these stories that I'm working on. And then, but then he drops it, and he drops it almost completely and then just recycles stuff from the from his older world. But then the two of them come together and the Lord of the Rings is the result. The Lord of the Rings is you know, when the Hobbit really sort of begins to crystallize and work together with all of those older things, when, you know, when they all combine together, and now, you know, when that world becomes the Third Age with the Silmarillion stuff behind it as the First Age, that's when I think, you know, the real richness of Tolkien's world and Tolkien's whole imaginative creation really comes together. And it starts with, you know, Bilbo. It starts with A Hole in the Ground There Lived a Hobbit. But you're absolutely right. As far as his own writing is concerned, and as far as his storytelling is concerned, I mean, I do think that if we don't get the Hobbit, and even if we don't get the Hobbit like it is, you know, that is with its roots in children's story, and yet, or rather with its beginnings in children's story, but with its roots back into, you know, the epics and sagas, and but then stepping forward, right, and bringing those things into sort of more serious and mature consideration by the end of The Hobbit. Yeah, I mean, that is, I mean, I agree. That's sort of ultimately kind of where The Lord of the Rings comes from.
Really, yeah. You know, and I do wonder, there's absolutely no way to ever know the answer to this question, but, you know, we do know that he had gotten some stuff published and was attempting to get things published, mostly poetry, if I recall correctly,
yeah,
prior to The Hobbit.
Yeah.
And then he did not actually submit the book. It was, I think, a student or a friend of the family who had,
yes,
connections to Alan Unwin, who's, and I just kind of wonder sometimes if, what his thought was. I mean, I almost wonder, it's like, oh, well, this will never get published. I mean, it's the poetry that, you know,
right,
it's my poetry that really deserves to be published. You know what,
yes,
I mean? It's like, I just wonder sometimes if it would, you know, kind of took him by surprise that a publisher would actually be interested in this book.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly very different. You know, it's certainly...
Well, especially when you look at, yeah, when you look at what he was trying to get published before.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, he's like, oh, you're interested in The Hobbit. That's great. How about The Lay of Lathian? Would you like to publish that?
Right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's much more worthy.
That's
you
where
know,
he
even,
went with
even
it.
Back to his days, you know, I mean, taken from John Garth's book, which is not just a great book talking about his World War I experience, but an awesome book talking about his years at King Edward's School. I mean, even back in those days, you know, he and his friends were very lofty in their poetry and their ambitions in terms of, you know, their literary ambitions. I mean, if somebody had told, Tolkien at age 17 or 18 that this is, you know, his first fame would come with this book, he would have been like, no way.
Right.
I mean, to kill myself now, you know.
Right, exactly. Exactly. What's the point of going on if that's
right,
yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it is just an interesting thing. Like I say, I mean, we'll never know for sure, but just sort of, it's just an interesting, I just wonder how surprised he was, you know, when he got the word that they were actually going to go forward with publishing this book.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, no, I think that that's I do think that that's a really good point. But, you know, bringing all this stuff, bringing all this stuff back to Thorin, and beginning to move forward into where we think Thorin is going to be going. Here's one of my big questions. Thinking again about the Golden King scene at the end of The Desolation of Smaug, where exactly is the arrow pointing with Thorin? We've had these, you know, things have been building towards Thorin, you know, going crazy, and things have been, you know, we saw the sort of the escalation of tension between Thorin and Bilbo over the Arkenstone. But doesn't it seem at the end of film two that he's taken a turn for the better? Is it just me who was getting that?
Yeah,
at the end of the second film. I mean, from that moment.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say it's interesting you say that because I was just thinking as you were talking that, in fact, I don't see that much dragon sickness. I mean, the dragon sickness that we've heard about has all been from interviews from Jackson and the actors. I mean, I think you even brought this up, that we don't see it that clearly in movie two. And I agree with you. I think he maybe starts to go down one path, but then the need to defeat the dragon pulls him completely out and puts him back to where he was before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that scene, and when he says, I'm forgetting the actual line. It's the one about, we'll all burn together.
Right. The one that wasn't in the book.
Yeah,
That Richard Armitage made a point of saying wasn't canon, which I thought was precious.
Right. In that scene, that sentiment, it's like a little crazy, I mean, like it's a little bit, wild-eyed thing to say, but nevertheless, it's still a leader thing to say.
You know, it's kind of consistent with how he's been. Like I said, I mean, he's kind of been this impulsive, hot-headed kind of warrior, from As an Old Bazaar Forward in the movies. So it's not that out of character. It's not a crazy thing really for Thorin to say in the heat of the moment, pardon
right.
the pun.
Right, exactly. And it's a unifying thing. We will stick together and I will lead you, and he's going to go in front and take the risks. He's the one who basically puts himself as bait to lure Smaug up towards the statue and it's I see what Thorin does at the end there as an entirely good sign. He seems to be. And this is, to me, of crucial importance when I'm thinking about the Battle of Five Armies. Because, as I've talked about before, as I think we're talking about last time in the context of discussing the Battle of Five Armies, when Thorin charges out of the gate, that is the turning point for him in the book. When he's turning from... Because that's the last we've seen him since Descendant of Rats, since he threatened to throw Bilbo off the wall to his death. The next time we see him is when he charges out of the mountains. Or I guess, you could say the last thing we got from him was just arrows shot from the wall when they come to ask for the treasure and to give the Arkenstone. But of course, Thorin won't even come out because Dan is about to arrive. And so, he's getting ready to attack them. Again, it's a dramatic turning point for Thorin when he has decided to do the right thing, when he has decided to embrace being a real king and a real leader instead of, being a selfish, self-absorbed, jerk like he was being at the gate. That shift was already less dramatic in the negative direction, but now has turned back. So my question is, are we going to get more of that? That is he going to relapse? Are we going to see him get crazier again? There are several ways that this could happen, that is to say, Yana says, for instance, that he wouldn't be surprised if the dragon sickness will still come into play, being exposed to the treasure itself, and the Arkenstone thing still hasn't run its course. Yeah, I agree. I mean, we could still see him go a little bit crazy again, or a lot crazy again, more crazy, dip down further than he dipped before. But see...
I just had this vision of Thorin looking at the Arkenstone and his eyes turn into spirals, like in a cartoon.
Right, exactly.
And then he goes berserk.
Right. Exactly. See, and it's exactly that cartoon image that you raise there is exactly why I don't believe that's going to happen. Because it would be cartoonish. Right?
It would. And the reason I was thinking actually that was because, again, I was going to bring up the pacing issue. If he does, fall into the abyss of madness, it's going to have to take a very short space of time in this movie because of all the other things that are going to be happening.
Yes. Yes. You know? No, I agree. I think it seems to me, this is why I can't imagine him just like being like, hey, the dragon's dead. Come, let us like, you know, roll around in the treasure like a, you know, like demented Scrooge McDucks and get like, you know, and go crazy about the gold. I don't think it's going to be about the treasure. It could be about the Arkenstone, but I don't believe the dragon when the dragon talks about the effect the Arkenstone is going to have on Thorin. I don't think that Smaug, it might be a controversial thing to say, but I don't think that Smaug is being straight up about this.
Well, that's why I think we're, you know, I wonder if we're just like being there's a mass hypnosis going on by Jackson and everybody else saying there will be dragon sickness. You know, so we come into the movie expecting dragon sickness, but in fact, really, it's not that obvious. Or
right, which is good. I mean, I respect that. I mean, had Thorin simply just become what Thror was, you know, which is like going around and fingering his gold and you know, cackling maniacally. Had he been doing that, that would not have been very interesting, nor would it have been very compelling. And I agree with you about pacing too. We're not going to get just sort of a long decline down, especially since the decline that was already happening in film two has, it seems to me, been interrupted. You know, he's already turned away from that. So right. In order to you know, re-begin the decline, he's going to have to go sharply downhill. And I think,
quickly.
Yeah. And that, it seems to me, requires, is going to require an incident. You know, there's going to be something that occurs which impels him, you know, which really pushes him off the edge. If he's going off the edge, he's got to be shoved off the edge by something. Now, this could still imagine that happening in several ways. Mm-hmm. Several people were pointing things out. That is the death perhaps of you know, Feely or Keely, you know, could do this.
Well, and Bilbo's betrayal with the Arkenstone. I mean,
yes. Yes. Well, exactly. I mean, that's where I think it's sort of most likely. And somebody, I was looking for the one, I forget who said this.
Kate Neville had a list that I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Well, no, but I was looking at, I forget who it was. Somebody was saying about how they think it's going to really bother him that he didn't kill Smaug.
Oh, Brian. I think it was Brian.
Was that Brian?
Brian, yeah.
You know,
perturbed by not being the one who lands the killing blow on Smaug.
Yes, yeah. Yes, exactly. I could see that too, but to me, I think the most likely thing is what he would perceive as a simple, flat-out betrayal by Bilbo.
Right.
You know, that right here at the bitter end, having done all this stuff, having sacrificed all these things, having come, you know, all this way and been through everything, now at the very end, his entire quest, his entire purpose, his entire attempt to reestablish his kingdom and his homeland for his people and to regain his throne is thwarted by the totally unanticipated and, as far as he can see, you know, like without even obvious motivation, betrayal by the Hobbit that, you know, that they brought along with them, that in the end, the whole thing. And so, like, anger against Bilbo, anger even against Gandalf, because like this was probably a plot. Remember, Thorin in the book accuses Gandalf of that, you know, that of you know, Gandalf of being in league against him. You know, so that idea of betrayal, you know, him believing that he's been betrayed is something that I could see shoving him way over the edge. But then Jonathan Harder makes the excellent point. And he says, but Bilbo's betrayal would have to be triggered by some craziness on Thorin's part, wouldn't it? I mean, because it's true in the book. If he hadn't already been acting irrationally in the book, Bilbo wouldn't have handed over the Arkenstone in the first place. So it's true. We still need, and this is where I still don't know, and it's because I don't know I still don't understand about the Arkenstone. I don't understand what it does. I don't understand the full significance that it has, not just symbolically. I think I do understand its symbolic significance in the movies. They've made that reasonably clear. But its actual significance, like its role in their plan. It's clear that stealing the Arkenstone was the core of their plan. If it actually has a function, if it actually performs some magical thing, if it in some, you know, whether that's, you know, sending up the dwarf signal to summon Dan or whatever, I don't know. But if it actually is not a mere symbol that they're trying to acquire, then I don't know. Like I said, to me that has a big impact on Bilbo's theft of the Arkenstone and Bilbo's handing of it over. It's one of the reasons why, when we've been talking about that in previous episodes, I am very willing to consider the idea that Bilbo is not going to be trying to hand over the Arkenstone in the same way that, you know, in the same way and for the same reasons that he does in the film, because it seems to be just different. It seems to work differently. Jana says, I don't think Thorin would have to be completely crazy to refuse the Elven King and Bard. They might be showed as being unreasonable too. Yes, but why does Bilbo make the... Bilbo clearly is motivated in the book by the fact that he believes Thorin is doing the wrong thing. And when Thorin starts talking about, like, you know, executing and torturing anyone, you know, any one of his friends, any one of the, you know, the 13 of them who keep the Arkenstone from him, you know, when he starts making Feanor-like speeches about the Arkenstone, that's when Bilbo's like, okay, we're done here. Right. First of all, he's acting unjustly, and now he's like acting crazy too. So I, Bilbo, am going to do the right thing, even though nobody else is doing the right thing. And let's see if we can bring these people to their senses. That seems to be his motivation in the book. I can't see, in order for Bilbo to get anywhere close to there, Jonathan is right that Thorin has to already kind of be over the edge for that to happen. He can't just... Thorin can't just be opposing them. Jana says,
well,
maybe,
you know, Thorin's already kind of displayed that kind of behavior. I mean, he's stubborn.
Yep.
He's opinionated. He won't budge when it comes to his hatred of the elves. You know what I mean? It's like, I could just see that sort of ramping up, but not necessarily call it sickness, to a point where Bilbo would want to take action.
Right.
I mean, it just seems like that's kind of the track that's been laid, if you will, in terms of Thorin's behavior and personality.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. But again...
Jana makes a good point of maybe he starts to get paranoid, you know? I mean, maybe there's some serious, like, really noticeable sort of paranoia, you're all against me kind of behavior.
Okay, well, here's a theory. I'm not especially fond of this idea. This is in my... I think it might happen, or it would be consistent with what we've seen in the second film, but I kind of hope that this isn't the answer kind of suggestions. But remember, we have the foundation laid for a tragic misunderstanding between Bilbo and Thorin. And I'm thinking of the scene in which Bilbo was refusing point blank to tell Thorin whether or not he found the Arkenstone.
Right.
Right. Why is Bilbo refusing? Because Smaug just told him if he gives the Arkenstone to Thorin, it's going to wreck Thorin. So it's quite possible that we have Bilbo withholding the Arkenstone for Thorin's own good, right? Because he thinks he's doing a favor to Thorin, though Thorin is obviously unappreciative of this favor. But Thorin, feeling that he's being betrayed and being increasingly suspicious of Bilbo, who was looking about as suspicious as it's possible to look, when Thorin was asking him in the second film, And so Thorin getting more and more frustrated and aggravated and suspicious because it looks like Bilbo is concealing the Arkenstone and betraying him, and having that be what... But Bilbo's motivation for that is, again, that he's just trying to protect Thorin from himself, but he doesn't even dare tell Thorin that he actually has the Arkenstone because he can't trust, you know...
Nor so, any of the other dwarves, likely. I mean, even Balin, he couldn't really tell.
Right, exactly. So, again, so we have the situation between them escalating, but it escalates not because Thorin is sort of acting in the wrong, as he does in the book, but just because of this kind of, as I say, it's just a tragic misunderstanding.
And that's actually what much tragedy is based on. That's right. Exactly the kind of situation that many tragic stories are based on. So
exactly.
That makes sense to me. And you know, we wouldn't know the first time we'll hear of, you know, out loud of Bilbo's concern about Thorin is when he takes it to the men and the elves. He'll tell them that he's concerned. I mean, that's, I think, the only way or on his face. It'll be, you know, the wonderful Martin Freeman, and we'll see it on his face, and he won't say. I mean, he's not going to be able to actually tell out loud unless he's alone with Roach or something.
Right.
You know, why is it he's keeping the Arkenstone?
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's... this is, in one way, an attractive idea. I said I'm not really particularly fond of it, but it's an attractive idea in the sense that... it's a way of creating tension between Bilbo and Thorin that is comparable to the tension in the book. We could see this leading to Thorin threatening to throw Bilbo to his death, for instance. And yet, neither character is in the wrong. And that, I think, is an option that
That would make a much more poignant story, I think. Really, don't you think?
But it would also... I could also imagine it being very attractive to the filmmakers who don't want to transform Thorin into a villain at this point.
Right.
So, anyway.
It'll be interesting to see. I mean,
it could work.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting... I think, you know, if I remembered to mention this to Laura, I mean, a conundrum for this episode, a good one, would be about, you know, does Thorin really, you know, obviously go mad?
Mm-hmm.
Or not, you know, I mean, it's just going to be really interesting to see, because I think, you know, kind of what we've fleshed out here is you could still have the same story, or maybe even a much more poignant story, without that overt
mm-hmm.
madness.
Yeah, and that really is kind of what I expect. I mean, I expect him to get a little intense at times, mm-hmm. but I don't expect him just to go crazy. Again, I think Smaug is lying. I mean, I don't...
Right.
Well, and for one thing, we know that somebody's got to be wrong, right? We overheard Gandalf and Elrond talking about how there's, like, congenital madness in the line of Durin.
Right.
And Smaug saying about how the Arkenstone drove them crazy. Well, who's right? You know, they can't both be right. Maybe they're both wrong, but they can't both be right. Because the line of Durin extends a good deal further back than the Arkenstone, which was found during the lifetime of Thror within the film world. Apparently.
You know, I wonder if that line... I actually wonder if that line in Elrond had more to do with the scene we've never seen except in trailers, which is the crazy Thryan, you know, dropping down on top of Gandalf and being kind of a crazy boy. It just dawned on me that, you know, that might have really been more of a foreshadow of that than anything, or in addition to Thorin. But anyway, so, side comment.
Yeah.
Well, then, and Gerald brings up the fact of the ring, too, but, you know...
The Dwarven Ring, yeah.
Which, of course, has become a phantasm in the movies.
It got mentioned. It did get mentioned. Very much to my surprise.
It's in the Lego set.
And it's in the Lego... Well, some ring is in the Lego set.
That's right. You're not sure which ring.
Some yet to be revealed.
We're assuming it's not the one ring.
Yeah, well, I mean, but...
Could be the Witch King's ring, I suppose.
Yeah, I still have, needless to say, an unswerving and intrinsic faith in the Lego sets. So, I shall never doubt the Lego sets again.
which one's been announced, but we haven't seen the good pictures of it. We'll wait until the game.
Yeah, we saw some like teaser pictures of the Lego set, but it was lame. You know, I want
it's the new one. It's the Erebor Lego set's been announced.
Yeah. Which is fine, but I want the real thing, man. I want the pictures on the back of the box. Yeah, I want the whole deal.
Who's getting flipped into the air?
Exactly. I want to see which bits in the Lego set are mechanized and in what ways.
I will say the one thing I found interesting is that Feely is one of the characters in that.
Yes, I agree. Feely was in the set, but I'm saving myself for the Lego episode.
I think they said in October, so we'll be looking at Lego sets in detail in the fall.
Can't wait for the Lego set episode. Been waiting all year for the Lego set episode. Okay. Anyway, so
actually, you know, Kate asked this, and you know, I had forgotten to mention at the top of the hour, or the top of the show, that the reason Dave's not here is that he's at San Diego Comic-Con this weekend. And by the way, Lego apparently is going to be quite in force there. You know, probably not just for The Hobbit, but for other things as well. So, you know, I'll be interested to hear from Dave if he trips over any Legos, and if so, what were they?
Absolutely. That's really, you know, Dave's exclusive interview with Peter Jackson will be of secondary interest compared
to... No, it's like, Dave, we want to hear about the Legos.
Exactly.
I don't care that you talked to Richard Armitage or
Martin
Freeman.
That's right. Yeah, whatever.
Tell us about the Legos.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see what Dave is able to dig up at Comic-Con.
Is Dave doing a Comic-Con broadcast? This is to be determined.
Yep, we're trying to figure this out.
We're going to try and get together to do a special broadcast of Dave's brain dump.
He's going to be
Comic-Con brain dump.
Is it tonight that he's going to be waiting in line all night for Hall H?
Yeah, and I saw somebody said something that I don't think they opened up the line until like 3 a.m.
Okay.
But bottom line, he's going to be in the Hall H line, and with the hopes of getting into the Hobbit panel tomorrow in Hall H.
Yeah, so that will be...
I mean, he kind of said in his note to us, I got the impression that his choice after that is either to continue to sit in his seat in Hall H for the other panels that are going to come up, or he'll go out and wander around the convention hall. So we'll see what he does.
Right. It would be fun to do a, you know, live broadcast from the line to Hall H.
Wouldn't that be cool?
He
bought a brand new record, you know, high end super duper recorder.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's actually it's a newer version of the one that I use.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. You know, it's interesting actually at Comic-Con, a side thing, it's like there was an announcement that Peter Jackson's going to be at Comic-Con, like it was a big surprise, and I thought to myself, he needs to be there because all the actors that will be participating with him in the panel are also there to you know, flog other things. I mean, Richard Armitage is there for another movie.
Right.
Graham Tavish is there for Outlander. Tariel is there for her book. I mean, you know, they're doing other things. So Jackson needs to be there to remind these people when they're in their panel. What movie is it we're talking about now? Because been a while for them. Anyway.
Right. Yeah, Lynn was just giving us the link to the Lego thing on theOneRing.net. Yeah, that's the one that we saw, which is okay, but I'm unsatisfied.
I'm not impressed.
It's too far away. I want the full details, man. Like, it's cool to see, you know, like, it's okay, but it's a small picture, and I want the full Lego marketing effect. I insist upon the pictures on the back of the box. Erica was saying she was hoping that today would include Dave in line from Comic-Con. Not quite yet. Today is still Dave in transit to Comic-Con, so we're a little previous for that. But we hope we stay tuned. Stay tuned
to hound him.
Our Facebook pages, to my Tolkien Professor Twitter feed, to see, and we'll let you guys know if we have any news about unexpected.
We have to get him early. You know, I want to get him beginning of the week so he doesn't forget stuff.
Yeah. At the very least, we want to get him at the beginning of next week. Anyway,
so back to Thorin.
Let's talk about Thorin's actual death here, which was theoretically the topic of the episode, and which we've not been getting. But I mean, the stuff we've been talking about is to me the most.
Release
the most.
Should we release the Kraken? Should we release the riddle? Or are you going to talk about
release
first?
The Kraken. Yeah. Okay. Let's go ahead and post the riddle.
Let's
so,
okay.
Our riddle today is just about Thorin's the scene with Bilbo. You know, the big scene with Bilbo. Where will it happen? And this might seem a sort of a simple question, like, who cares where they happen to be standing when, or sitting, or lying, or whatever, kneeling, when they have the conversation? But I actually think it makes a big change in the whole dynamics of the scene. So our riddle is, where will the deathbed conversation occur? And our options are A, in a tent in Dale, that's the book answer, B, on the battlefield, C, inside the
either
mountain.
Either during or after.
Right, either right. during or after. During. I say, you know, either like the conversation between Thorin and Bilbo happens with, like, you know, the battle still swirling around them, or, you know, they're like the two of them are there in the middle of a field of slain and having the conversation.
With some great Howard Shore music in the background.
Great Howard Shore music. Yeah, vampire bats fixing upon the fallen.
Oh, God.
You know, all that kind of thing. And anyway, so that's B. C, vampire bats are not an obligatory element of B.
For B.
You can, in fact, vote for B without voting for the vampire bats. I just want to make that perfectly clear. C is inside the mountain. D is the conversation doesn't occur, which we have to ask just for the sake of completeness, though I am no more thinking that that will not happen than I was thinking that Thorin would not die,
right.
And or E, none of the above. The none of the above options are comparatively limited, but...
and if anybody can think of any besides any that we posed...
Yeah, the only E answer, sure. Trish, and I could come up with was, like on top of the mountain. Like, you know,
yeah.
If I don't know. It's a little hard to imagine where else they could
My
be.
My scenario was something along the lines of an echo of the end of Return of the King, where Gandalf asks the eagle, you know, an eagle to take Thorin up from the battlefield because he's wounded. And, you know, the eagle picks him up and deposits him, like, by the secret door on the side of the mountain.
Right, but they'd also have to bring Bilbo there for the conversation, you know. That,
oh, that's true, yeah.
I
or
don't
Bilbo
know.
Could just race through inside the mountain and get to the secret door.
exactly, yeah. So I don't know. Taking him up to the top of the mountain is kind of attractively, you know, Silmarillion echoing. At least I find that echo attractive. You know,
Gandalf.
Yeah, it's like the, yeah. Yeah, the you know, yeah, the funeral beer of Fingolfin.
Ah, Yannis is on the shores of the lake. That's another possibility.
Thorin is killed and then falls into the river
sand.
And his corpse washes down and they have to drag the lake to find his body. But he's still alive and gives his speech to Bilbo, like, you know, vomiting water out of his lungs. It might, you know, kind of cut into the dramatic effect a little bit, but it could still work. the context of the death scene, I think, is going to be interesting. But again, and what I'm interested in this question is because I think it actually has, it provides a really important context to the sort of the nature of the conversation. If they meet on the battlefield, it will say, like, basically, the book answer, right, is in a tent in Dale. Think about what is the significance of the fact that he is in a tent in Dale. There are several things that we can see there, right? One is the fact that Bilbo has to be taken there after the battle. Remember, Bilbo wasn't involved in the battle, and the battle is long over when he finally wakes up from his concussion while invisible, right? So the fact that it's a tent in Dale instead of on the battlefield is not only shows the timing that it's well after the battle, but more importantly, again, Bilbo wasn't in the battle. So the idea of if Thorin and Bilbo meet on the battlefield, it's going to be because Bilbo's connection to Thorin during the battle, and therefore Bilbo's involvement in Thorin's death. Not that I'm accusing Bilbo of killing Thorin, but you understand, like, the fact that he's going to be involved there in
right.
in Thorin's final battle.
Right.
that really changes the dynamics, not only of Bilbo's character in general, but of their conversation in particular. If right. if the deathbed conversation comes as a product of Bilbo just having stepped in and saved Thorin's life again, for instance, you know, mm-hmm. so say, you know, say the story happens that, you know, Thorin thinks that Bilbo has betrayed him for whatever reason. Bilbo actually does it. And then in the battlefield, they encounter each other on the battlefield again. But like Bilbo comes in and rescues Thorin, and Thorin's response to that is to be like, oh, you're all right after all, Bilbo Baggins. Let's recapitulate the man hug that we had on the Carrick at the end of film one. Except this time I'm dying and I'll also bleed on you while I do this. Like that's a very different context for the deathbed conversation right. than we get in the book. Right? In the book, we get it's after the battle. Bilbo's not involved in the battle. Bilbo was utterly irrelevant to Thorin's death itself. Instead, Thorin has just been reflecting on Bilbo, saying, I now, from my current perspective at the edge of the grave, and after my, you know, my conversion experience, you know, after after I turned the corner and decided to become a Eucatastrophe instead of a villain, I now see things differently. And I now not only appreciate the reasons why you did what you did with the Arkenstone, but I now value your whole point of view more. You know, that's the heart, that sentence about, you know, if more people valued, you know, food and cheer and you know, food and song and good cheer above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world. That sentiment is the sentiment of someone who is reflecting on the meaning of life
exactly.
before he's dying, you know.
In relative quiet.
In quiet, yes. So yes. that so, it's hard to imagine. I mean, I can imagine them putting that line in the mouth of Thorin on the battlefield because that line is in the book, but it wouldn't right. fit. I mean, I don't think it would fit nearly so well in that kind of a context. And not to mention the fact, if Bilbo has been involved, even if he doesn't succeed in saving Thorin's life, if Bilbo is involved with Thorin on the battlefield in some presumably admirable and possibly heroic way, that's going to color their conversation there at the end. Yeah. So again, this is why I think the where does it occur question is my indirect way of wanting to get at these bigger issues about the quality of that, you know, the nature of that conversation and how... you know, where the emphasis is going to lie in their deathbed conversation. Right. Now, inside the mountain, that's also a different... But, oh, anyway, hang on a second. I only did half of the significance of the Tent and Dale answer, right? One half is that it's not on the battlefield, that it's after the battlefield. It's now the battlefield recalled in tranquility, just like Wordsworth would do. And so... But the other thing is that it's in a tent in Dale, right? He has been taken into the camp of his former enemies. He's in one of the tents of the army that was lying, besieging his... fortress, mm-hmm. right? It is a very clear sign of the peace that has broken out. They didn't just declare a temporary truce until the goblins were killed, and now we can get back to fighting each other. The fact that he has been taken into their camp shows that, you know, peace has been established, you know, good and proper. And that I think is an important thing. And also, things attached, peace in a sense, sort of like on their term. Again, they've brought him into their camp, right? They have accepted Thorin and honored Thorin. It's different from if it's inside the mountain, right? Inside the mountain
right.
now puts it all into the regal King Under the Mountain context, yeah. right? You know, are we going to get the deathbed of a king? Right? Are we going to get Thorin lying in state in the gold, in surrounded by gold in Erebor? And the thing is, that it would seem to me would be a very logical endpoint of the trajectory of Thorin's character.
Well, I could see a very dramatic procession.
Yep.
From the Tent and Dale yep. to the mountain.
Yeah. Now we know he's going to get buried, right? We know he's going to yeah. get buried in the mountain.
Yeah.
Eventually. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, the question is the procession a funeral procession into the mountain, or do they carry him? I mean, I can easily imagine Thorin saying,
or do they carry him still alive?
Right. Say, either Thorin saying, or like Balin saying, he would want to die in Erebor. He doesn't want to die in some nasty tent in Dale.
Take me to Erebor.
Right. Yes. Take me to the house of my fathers. Brian Fattorini says, "Bury me with my money." sort of. But the symbolic significance of that, I think, the symbolic significance of him dying, not just being buried, but dying in the mountain, I think is really powerful. Not very powerful would be the conversation never occurring. Like I say, I don't.
Oh God, I can't imagine Jackson saying, "Oh no, we don't need that."
Right. Yeah.
Or Boyens, you know, it's like, no, we can cut that out.
Yeah. Yeah. God, I've been reading through this book and I found a bunch of scenes I think we can just do away with. And, you know, this one is pretty much at the top of my list. Like, you know, seriously, that doesn't move the plot forward at all.
I have a side question that doesn't actually move us forward on the riddle at all, but I'll just pose it. Is I wonder if the Arkenstone will actually get buried with Thorin, or if it'll get put back in the top of the throne now that its significance has changed so much in the movie that it's the, you know, it's the symbol of the king under the mountain. I wonder if they're actually going to bury it with Thorin now.
Yeah, yeah, it's an excellent question.
Well, that's another conundrum possibility. Actually.
Yeah. That's actually an excellent conundrum. I like that one even better.
Yeah, okay. Boy, you know, A, B, and C, all three are all very good, I think, ways to portray.
Yeah, I consider E unlikely because it's hard to find a really, truly plausible alternative. Yeah. And D, I find... so appalling, I refuse to recognize that it could exist. but I think that A, B, and C are all of them really good possibilities. Mark Flessa has a really cool idea. He says, I wouldn't be surprised to see Bilbo giving Thorin the Arkenstone on his deathbed and Thorin refusing it. Yeah, that would be interesting. That would be interesting. Symbolically, I'm not sure.
I could see Thorin taking it and handing it to Dian.
Yes.
On his deathbed.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Bilbo's like, gee, sorry I took this. I didn't know it was going to lead to your death.
Yeah, right. Sorry. Really kind of miscalculated on the whole Arkenstone thing. It's just, you know, the dragon said this, and I feel really dumb in retrospect, you know, but, yeah.
So, yes, I did. To answer the question you asked an hour ago, yes, I do have a Arkenstone.
Right. Yeah, exactly. In fact, I've really had it all along. I was to never mind. I feel stupid, but here you are. Yeah. Maybe that's just how it should go, too. Be very dramatic. Be very moving scene. I have to say, I am inclining on my, you know, oft-declared principle for season 3, in the interest of choosing what is awesome over what is likely. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with C.
So what's the most awesome of A, B, and C?
C is the most awesome. I love the idea.
Oh, God, the number just went up as a result of you saying that.
Fools!
The numbers of A and B should go up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yes. I do think that... But C, I find C
Brian.
Really compelling. I find C
Brian
really
said he
compelling.
C'd before it was cool.
I find C really compelling as a way, just thinking back to what we spent most of the episode talking about, thinking about the way that Thorin's story trajectory goes, you know, thinking about the way in, you know, how will the last page of Thorin's life story go? The idea of him returning to the mountain and You know, the whole Return of the King thing is so prominent with Thorin. I mean, it is the center of the Thorin story in the film. The idea of having, you know, you could still capture this by having him die on the battlefield and show a, you know, a royal funeral in Erebor. Like, I mean, you can get there. So yeah, I mean, Timothy Fisher was just suggesting that, you know, that he dies on the battlefield and then, you know, we get the funeral procession. Yeah, but it's not the same. You know, it's hard to, I don't know. I mean, the idea, the image of Thorin dying as king, you know, in Erebor is a really attractive one. So, yep, I'm going to go with C. I'm going to go with C. Again, I don't think it's likely, necessarily. If I had to choose what I believe to be most statistically likely, I'd say B, but...
Well, but you know, I mean, your point about the golden statue, you know, and the symbolism of that. I mean, C continues kind of that trend, you know, the significance of Thorin being in the mountain before he dies. I could definitely see that, and you know, like I said, Jackson's proven to whether. Of course, the question is whether Jackson actually saw as deep into that symbolism as you saw into it in the golden statue situation, but I can see that now. So I'm just completely don't know what I'm going to say. So walking through all this, I mean, B to me is a kind of appellant, a Theoden on Pelennor Fields kind of death, you know, where Bill, you know, Bilbo, and it could very well be similar in the sense that Bilbo's been fighting by Thorin's side kind of thing, and maybe even saved him, like you say, once, mm-hmm. if not twice on the battlefield, but then misses the save on the third or, you know, round.
Right.
Oops! I was tying my shoe. and that could be extremely poignant, you know, where the sounds of the battle dim out, you know, and everything gets like blurred behind them, and it's just the two of them having this conversation, was kind of where I was at. Now, the tent also, that, you know, the whole idea of him being in the camp of what had been his enemies. And I think in both of those cases, I don't think we could have either of those without having a funeral procession into the mountain. But and the inside of the mountain. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to say.
Yeah, I do think. I mean, the funeral march into the mountain is like an absolute given. I mean, there's a 0% chance that doesn't happen. I mean, that's obviously.
Yeah, if he dies outside, well, there's going to be a procession one way or the other. Like you say, I mean, in your choice, it's a procession while he's still alive, being carried into the mountain. The other two is he's died and carried in. But yeah, I think that's just a given. I don't know. I think I'm going to say B. Not any real good reason other than perhaps just for the economy of film time.
Yeah.
You know, it's a poor reason for me to choose
well,
that.
Well, that's exactly why I think it's statistically most likely. Because it's the most efficient by far.
Right.
You know, if you're going to move the deathbed scene into the mountain, you've got to basically introduce a whole new scene. Whereas, you know, it can be appended. It can be either like Theoden's death scene with the battle going on around them, or it can be like Boromir's death scene with all the enemy dead around them. But it's a very natural kind of transition. In that way, it's a very natural film transition in particular. And I'm not even sure, I mean, you know, I'm calling it most awesome. I don't even know that it would necessarily work really well. I can imagine doing it, but when I imagine doing it, you know, what I imagine is Thorin lying there mortally wounded and he knows he's going to die and people being like, we will get you help, Thorin, and Thorin saying no. But then just Thorin saying, you know, take me to Erebor. You know, I want to return to my home. I want to, you know, if I'm going to die, I want to die in Erebor. And you know, have like, again, we've got a big Howard Shore moment, right? As like, you know, Dwalin and Balin, you know, bear him up on their shoulders.
Oh my gosh, yeah,
and
we'll have the reprise of the theme of Durin, you know, the Misty Mountains.
Yeah.
To carry him.
Yeah, exactly. And he like staggers forward and enters into the hall of the king, right? You know, we see him walking in through the gates and okay, probably then he shouldn't say, well, I'm back. But but anyway, that would kind of undo the dramatic moment. Tempted as I always am, I still think that would have been the
Bilbo
best way.
Bilbo actually has to say that at the end of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But anyway.
I did, as a side note, by the way, it tickled me that I saw a serious news report that Jackson has promised that we're not going to have multiple endings in The Hobbit the way we did in Lord of the Rings.
Well, yeah, the structure of it is totally different. Though
I know. Though, I thought that was funny.
Though I think he's lying. I mean, because we are going to get still, I believe, what your casual moviegoers will consider multiple endings.
Endings,
you know,
sure.
We'll get the climax of the battle and the death of Thorin.
Right.
And that's going to seem like the end to a lot, but that's not going to be the end.
Surely he'll be passing through Rivendell. I can't believe they would.
Yeah, we've got to have some elements of the homeward journey, right?
We may have Saruman turning bad. Right, we may get a little glimpse
we may have some White Council wrap up to do.
Right.
We may even have some. Meanwhile, where is Sauron up to do?
That's right.
And
we have the auction
and the frame narrative. Are we going to return? We've got to return
to the frame narrative.
So, so I think he's lying. But anyway,
shall we answer for? I'll channel Dave.
Yeah,
and I'll say, "Damn you, Corey Olson! I was going to go for A, but now I believe it's C." How was that?
That's pretty good. Actually, you know, maybe he would say A. You think Dave would say A to this?
Can we do that? We'll do that.
Yeah,
we'll do A. I was thinking he would say.
Let's
A.
Put Dave on A.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, yeah.
I'm showing not quite 3/4 people voted. We'll see the ignition of the Eye of Barad.
Exactly, yeah. Brian is saying we'll see the ignition of the Eye. We need to have, you know, the Nazgul all standing around because, you know, they've been working really hard and sprucing up Barad-dûr and have Sauron come back. And
holding a feather duster, one in a...
Exactly, right. And then they'll have like a ribbon-cutting ceremony at Barad-dûr,
right.
You know.
Right.
Yep. And they're going
to
flip the switch and the big eye will light up.
We talked about this before, and I would think it would be feasible for Jackson to do this just to remind us about him, which is Gollum leaving the Misty Mountains. No,
yep.
No dialogue required.
Yep.
That could be a part of the wrap up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Timothy, there's not an all of the above answer. I'm sorry. We're not going to have this conversation rambling. We're not going to have like a deathbed conversation between Thorin and Bilbo and then have them be
walking.
Like, exactly. Have them be like, shall we walk over there while we continue talking? Walk with me. Yes, exactly. Let us stroll while we have this conversation. Yeah. No.
You know, I could actually see, you know, the In the Mountain one too. I think you just mentioned this, whereas maybe they're carrying him like on a stretcher or something, but when they get to the doors, he demands to be, you know, helped up, and he will walk through.
Right,
he'll walk through over the threshold on his own steam, and then, of course, collapse after that. But that would
yep.
be another.
I could see this.
Very,
I could see this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert Brown, Death Eagle. You know, I was telling Corey beforehand with, you know, when we were talking about the None of the Above, and I said it could be that Gandalf asked the Eagles to go get him. You know, which wouldn't be out of the ordinary because he did the same thing with Frodo and Sam at the end of Return of the King, thinking that Frodo and Sam were dead. And I said, well, I'm sure the Eagles. You know, this could mean that the Eagles actually have a sideline. You know, corpses are us. You call
right,
us.
Right.
We'll pick
corpse
them up
removal
for you.
In a jiffy.
Corpse removal. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Corpse retrieval, really, is what they
are
offering.
That's true.
Yeah.
Corpse retrieval.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You call
Do you have
us,
a loved one who has died in some kind of heroic and out of the way fashion? We can arrange to retrieve
call
the body
us.
Of your
Our
loved one.
Our laws are standing by.
That's right. Yep. Yep.
Oh, you know, I'll have to say when I post this up on Facebook that we just laughed and laughed through the death of Thor.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Download our app.
Download our app, yep. That's right.
Yeah, well, good. Okay, well,
that'll work.
You know,
that'll work.
Yeah, that'll work. I'm going to sit here and write. Oh, so actually, we have 82% voted according to my screen.
Okay, good. Yeah, let's close the poll.
Should we close it? Okay, we'll close the share. All righty. And then I think we're wrapped up on the main part. We have some cool announcements to make, I know. So
yeah, we do. though I would like to point out that I seem to have led at least 30% of the people down the primrose path with me here.
Although Brian made the point of saying he seed before.
Yeah, I think Brian was the only one crazy enough to vote for that before I made my pitch. But
somebody on the Riddles in the Dark page said something like, "Damn you, Corey Olson, you're more persuasive this year than you have been any other year."
Yeah. No, cool.
That's good.
Cool. All right. So announcements. First announcement is a particularly exciting announcement, and this is actually the first time I'm announcing this anywhere. And actually, you know, those of you who are here with me, with us here today, are some of the main people that I wanted to deliver this announcement to. Signum University, the academic institution behind the Mythgard Institute, and all this other stuff, we are looking for help. We've been building a staff. We've had a lot of people who have been helping us out in various ways. We have a large team of people now who are coming together to work, you know, as many hours a week as you can, and really helping us out with a whole bunch of things. You know, we have a great deal of work being done by our excellent team of semi-volunteers. And I say semi-volunteers because although we're not in a place where we can afford to pay fat salaries at this point, what we can offer is work-study credit.
Or thin salaries.
Or thin salaries, for that matter. Exactly. What we can give is tuition remission. If you are interested in our Mythgard classes, if you have been interested in our Mythgard classes and would like to take our Mythgard classes but have not been able to afford our Mythgard classes, we, of course, try to make our Mythgard classes as affordable as we possibly can, and we charge as little as we can possibly charge for them. We do still have to charge for them because teachers deserve to be paid for what they do. But nevertheless, what we are offering now is essentially a work-study program. So if you would like to get involved at Mythgard and Signum and help out with what we're doing, we would be happy to thank you by giving you tuition remission for our classes so that you could take classes with us for free, or rather in exchange for your assistance with the stuff that we're doing. So if you are interested in this, if you are interested in the possibility of either auditing or taking for credit one of the classes that we offer, one or more of the classes that we offer with the Mythgard Institute, I encourage you to sign up. We have, Gabrielle says, what would helping out involve? Really, there are lots of different options. Let me tell you a little bit about some of the options that we have. We need help with people on the outreach front. That is, people to help with press media, people, you know, so if you have journalism experience, we need you. We need help with social media, generating social media content. That's another area where we need help. There's a bunch of more kind of,
business oriented
work. We need, if anyone with bookkeeping or accounting experience would be fantastic. We definitely will have fundraising projects. We will have, we're putting into place a big new student record system this year. So there's going to be lots of fun work to be done in the wild and crazy world of data entry. Tobias asks, can you live out even help out even if you live overseas? Yes, indeed. In fact, some of our team leaders are overseas. We have people in leadership roles on the Signum staff who are based in Europe. So
our goal is world domination.
Yes. Well, at least world inclusion. At least that's step one, is global inclusion. Absolutely. It's one of the things about Mythgard and Signum is that, you know, we are a completely virtual entity, which means we're a totally global entity. So absolutely, you can help out if you live overseas.
Now, I think, by the way, I think, you know, to address maybe a bit of Gabrielle's question, I assume this was involved in the question, is as far as I know, we don't really have a structure of saying X number of hours
no.
of volunteering, you know, goes to this much tuition remission, but it's almost like a case-by-case basis, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I give a basic rule of thumb, just so that you have some kind of idea. If you could consistently, you know, pitch in with like one, two, 3 hours a week of work, we'd be happy to give you an auditor's seat for that. If you can pitch in more, you know, more around the 5 hours or so a week, I'd be happy to give you a full credit class enrollment for that. Yeah, there's definitely, we're very flexible with what we can, you know, with sort of placing people in different roles and different jobs. And there are lots of jobs to be done. So, I encourage you to,
So now people are, so there's a form, right?
There is a form. Let me both tell it to you so that those listening to the podcast can hear it and also, show it to you. Here, those of you who are watching, here it is on my screen. The address is signumuniversity.org. So that's SIGNUM university.org/volunteer.
That's easy.
Yep. SignumUniversity.org/volunteer. So this is a very simple form. Just to give us your name and email address, estimate about, you know, how many hours do you think you might be able to invest per week? And then, you know, do you have, you know, particular training or experience that might be useful or relevant, you know, that you think, and then tell us where you, how you know about us. And then, you know, just type something at the bottom. Give us as much information as you can. The more information you give about the kinds of things you would like to do and the kinds of things you are qualified to do and the kinds of things that you are, you know, good at doing or have expertise in, the more, then, you know, the better I can sort of place people into, you know, onto teams that are going to be, you know, doing stuff that would be beneficial. But like I said, our work study program, we have now over a dozen, about going on 20 people who have been contributing in this way, and the work that they have done has been just fantastic. It's been a really transformative thing for Signum University. And you know, the other thing that I would say about this, although we can't afford to pay salaries fat or thin now, you know, we can you know, provide you with tuition remission. Of course, the other things that we can provide you with are references and work experience. If there's something that you want to get experience in that you might like to be able to include on your resume, we can help you with that. You know, we can
Absolutely.
Help you to be able to get some experience. We can help you brainstorm a really awesome job title to give yourself. That's fine. I'm totally flexible like that.
You can update with LinkedIn, and you can get people to give you recommendations on LinkedIn. So
yeah. And of course, when the time comes, as I believe it will come, you know, when the time comes that we are in fact able to, you know, afford to pay people and to build a real part-time and full-time staff, obviously the people that I'm going to be first looking to hire will be, you know, those who have made themselves most indispensable, you know, in the time between now and then. That's kind of an obvious thing. So,
but now we're not talking 6 months there. When we want to set people's expectations.
Yes. Yeah. We're talking that's likely to be
years.
Yeah. A couple years down the road, before that's able to turn into a real thing. So basically if you're someone who is looking for, you know, a paying job right away, this is not going to lead to a paying job, you know, this year. This is not going to lead to a paying job probably next year. But you know, if this is, especially if, you know, if Mythgard is something that you've been excited about, if you'd like to pitch in, you know, if this is something that you would like to, you know, both to sort of see continue and to help flourish and, you know, and be a part of, you know, now and in years to come, you know, I think this is a really good opportunity. So just, wanted to make sure that everybody knew about this this opportunity, and you know, I want to make this available to
and
folks.
Spread the word. Well,
yeah.
Obviously, this is going to go out in the podcast, and we'll be probably promoting it some more, won't we? Else in social media and other places, I would imagine.
That's right.
So feel free to share the share the news.
Yeah, you can also, of course, email me directly, but I do encourage you to fill out the form so that we can have some information to work with there. So that's our first announcement. The second announcement, which is like it, is that we have officially opened registration for our fall courses. That's now open. So if you go to mythgard.org, you will be able to find the fall classes. The fall 2014 courses are my. I'm doing my Lua. We mentioned this, I think, in the last episode, but they weren't open for registration.
I mean, I'll put in another promotion here. I mean, if you have not done courses and are looking at, I mean, this is a very tough course if you've not done any of these courses. The Lewis and Tolkien course, I can't say enough good about. This was a great, great, great course. I did it when he was first offered, and I've heard just awesome things about Amy Sturgis's science fiction courses. And of course, with the Roots of the Mountain, Doug Anderson, gosh, you know, that's another one too. But one of the things about Roots of the Mountain is it's going to be fantasy before Tolkien. So, we'll be talking, I'm sure, about Tolkien to some degree, but it's really going to be focusing on the works, you know, prior to, I guess, like The Hobbit. So so we know that. But I think all three of them are just awesome choices.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's this. I'm really excited about the classes. I mean, I know I'm always excited about our classes, but I mean, that's why I do them, because I'm excited about them. this is a really, really cool lineup. So, anyway, so those are the classes that we're doing now. Those are open. Those are open for enrollment. You can, click on, current courses. You can click, in the admissions part. If you go to each one of the courses, there's individual links to enroll in the classes. So, it will take you right over to the registration page. So anyway, so that's where that's what's going on at Mythgard and Signum now. We have some other news, some Mythmoot-related news. Right, Trish?
Am I supposed to jump in
there? Yeah, go ahead. Okay. Why don't you jump in there?
The proceedings from last year's Mythmoot, Mythmoot 2, are up. They are the papers, some of the papers, not all. And the reason not all is because some of the folks that were presenting will be publishing their papers.
Right.
So in that case, they provided us their abstracts, but not the actual publishable paper, are up on Mythgard. And let's see, they are there's actually a post about them being open. So if you go to the Mythgard site, and you can either probably search on Mythmoot, or it should be on the front page, that the proceedings are available, and they're downloadable versions of the papers. So I think you should find them. They were amazing, just an amazing array of papers. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, to follow in on that, the call for papers for Mythmoot 3 is still open.
Yep.
Deadline for submission is August 31st. So if you have, an idea you've been wanting to develop and would like to present to a body of very kind, receptive folks, this is the place for that. So be sure to do that, and that is up also on the site, on the Mythmoot page. So if you go to Activities and Mythmoot under the Mythgard banner, you can get there. And of course, registration for Mythmoot 3 is open. Early bird prices are still in effect and will be until the end of August. So we've been getting a steady flow of people in, and I think there's some veterans as well as new people that I've been seeing on the list.
Yeah.
So it'll be very interesting. And did you want to say, do we want to announce, we do have our first special guest, right?
Oh, yes, we do have our first special guest. Amy Sturgis, the lecturer of the science fiction class, is going to be coming. So we're going to have her speaking on, she can talk about Tolkien too, but she's going to be addressing some non-Tolkien subjects as well, as we're going to be, involving in the conversation other, works of fantasy, right. other genres and science fiction and stuff. So, she should be fantastic.
Because Amy is not just a faculty member of Mythgard, but she actually has a standing in her own right.
Oh, correct? Man, she's one of the speakers at Worldcon this year. That is the right. big global science fiction convention where they actually announce the Hugo Awards and stuff. Where it's like how you get to vote on the Hugo Awards is if you, if you're like a Worldcon member. So she's one of the speakers there this year at, at Worldcon in London. So yeah, no, she's pretty awesome. Anyway, yeah, so that's that should be really fun. There's another special guest or two that we're working on. We'll come back with that, but more on that later.
Right. Right.
But that is.
And then we have Arrakis. Right?
Yes, that's right. The new Mythgard Academy class begins next Wednesday. We're doing Dune by Frank Herbert. And I am very excited to talk about Dune. I love that book. It's been a favorite book of mine for a really long time. So we're going to be starting, you know, looking at the opening of Dune in Caladan, starting next week. So the class is shifting. It's been on Tuesday nights for most of the year. It's going to be shifting to Wednesday nights, so as not to conflict with Doug Anderson's Roots of the Mountain class, actually. But yeah, so we're going to be talking about Dune next Wednesday, starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Very excited about it. So make sure to spread the word to, you know, your like science fiction fan friends, you know, who might not necessarily share your love of Tolkien, but might be interested in this. It would be fun to get some other people involved in this. So do spread the word. Okay, good. Very good.
Yep.
And I need to run, but this was a fun episode. I, as you said, it's sort of a surprisingly upbeat episode for a deathbed scene episode, but nevertheless.
Well, you know, I set the tone with my very upbeat tap.
Exactly. Yeah, that was really, it was the perfect symbol of the entire episode. Taps, but you know, done in a
jazzy,
quick and upbeat, jazzy fashion. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Putting
the fun in funeral, says Philip Lord. Exactly. Riddles in the Dark. Putting the fun in funeral.
That's
an excellent slogan. All right. So, anyway, well, thank you for listening, and Godspeed.